Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week it's Jumper, and I'm joined by David. How are you, David?
I am well. How about yourself?
Good. There's a habit of naming the shows by their number, and I refuse to do that. I've decided now that that naming them by their number implies that, well, it just seems so like, you know, you've only just started doing it. We've been doing this for a while now. First with Ron and Alex, and of course, still with Alex, but hopefully we'll get Ron back again soon. But we're so glad that you can join us, and you've become a bit of a regular also over on This Week in Media, I notice.
Yes, I have. It's quite a bit of fun, and it's really cool kind of making new friends. I've gotten a lot of nice emails from people who've appreciated what I've had to say, so it's been a lot of fun.
I must admit, I think this last few This Week in Media's, not that it was bad before, but it's really become incredibly interesting, some of the debates that have been going on. I thought really, really good, and I can recommend that show if people haven't listened to it, that they should definitely check it out.
Yeah, I recommend it even when I'm not on it.
So, this week we're talking about Jumper, and I guess the bottom line is, initial impressions when you saw the film?
I didn't not like it, but I didn't, it was a take it or leave it for me, which was a little disappointing, because I'm a big Doug Liman fan, and I thought the trailer was really, really well done. I was really excited to see the movie, and then it just kind of left me with a meh feeling, for lack of any other descriptor.
Well, I need to fess up here and say that one of my business partners, Jeff Huser from FX Guide, actually did work on the film and works at Hydraulix, who was one of the VFX houses. But I say that I should also say that I have no inside knowledge from Jeff on this, because I deliberately, you know, he obviously respects the confidentiality of the company, so my opinions are only mine, but I will fess up to the fact that he was on it. And I must say, going into this film, I had seen nothing but bad reviews, so I was actually getting pretty much ready to hate it when I walked in, and that really wasn't the case.
Oh yeah, I didn't hate it by any means, but to me it's one of those movies that if you don't see it in the theater, not a big deal. If you don't get a chance to rent it and you just catch it on cable, still not a big deal, but it's not like your life will be a complete disaster if you don't see this movie, but it's not going to be a disaster if you're dragged to see this movie either. It just is.
So let's discuss the visual effects for a second. Let's discuss mainly the visual effects and not just a movie review. And of course, the premise of the film is that the guy can teleport and jump, and does so with alarming regularity all over the world, which, you know, begs the question: how do you go about placing him in landmarks all over the world? Did you watch it knowing how they pulled that off?
I didn't. As I was watching it, I kind of had a few assumptions, and then read about it afterwards. I like to go into these movies, you know, not, you know, short of movies that friends of mine have worked on or that are very obvious how they're done. I try to go into any movie not having a lot of background information on how the movie was done, because it takes me out of the movie, because they'll get to a sequence, I'm like, oh, that's the shot that was killing so-and-so for 4 weekends, and that's why we didn't get to go hang out and have dinner. So I like to try to, you know, as much as possible, go in as any other viewer would go into a movie without any background knowledge. So, but as I was watching the movie, I was thinking, wow, these are some really nice sets they've built. And then I was, you know, I'm like, wow, it's a lot of blue screen work. And then I realized they just actually went to all these places, which was really refreshing, I thought.
Yeah, there's a history with the director and Bourne Identity and of actually getting out and traveling, but they were quite mobile in their travels, in the sense that they weren't traveling with a big crew, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I thought, you know, the idea of going to a location like the Arctic, you know, you have a thing in your script that says, okay, we're going to film this in the... or, you know, this is set in the Arctic, a lot of people would say, okay, well, we'll build a styrofoam ice floe and we'll put it into a pool that's heated to 85 degrees, and then we'll put our actor in there so he's nice and comfortable, and we'll digitally add in breath afterwards to make it seem cold. That's one approach, and that's what the approach I think a lot of people would take nowadays. And Doug Liman said, no, we're going to go to the Arctic, with five people. Hayden Christensen's gonna do his own makeup, and we're gonna coat him in cooking oil because if we coated him in water to make him look wet, he would be hypothermic and die. And while many people might want that after seeing the Star Wars movies, it's
No,
not.
no,
It's
I'm sorry, I'm going to get a judge's ruling on that one. But I think it's great that they went to the locations. It didn't mean that the film was sans visual effects, though, because clearly the jump to get to each of those locations was a very stylized thing. But you're right, I think it was interesting that they went, and I also think it was interesting that they were so guerrilla.
I thought it was kind of that trend, although that's a hard word to use for only a few movies, but that kind of trend of a director who has a very independent mind set, like meaning not independent as in striking out on his own, but independent from independent film type thinking, where we're just gonna go and we're gonna do this, and we're gonna shoot with the light we have, we're gonna shoot with the locations we have, and we're not gonna mess around. As you know, it's about what's going on the screen, not all the fake production value we can put into the screen. And I really admire it. I like the idea of going out there and having a location and shooting the location and finding your frames there rather than art directing the heck out of it on a set. I really appreciated that
Okay,
aspect of it.
so one of the aspects about going guerrilla, which I only discovered after I've seen it, so this is for me a complete validation, is the fact that some of those guerrilla shoots, those five-person shoots that you describe, such as the sitting on the surfboard stuff, was actually shot second unit with the red camera. So this is a major Hollywood film where there were intercutting red footage shot digitally with traditional main unit footage, and I've got to say, I didn't think there was any noticeable difference in the footage.
Nor did I. I didn't even know that until I read the material afterwards. I think this is probably the first film that was done with the red. That was like not the first film that's been done, but the first film that's made it to the theaters. And it looked like any other film stock up there. The sequence they used it in, it wasn't an effect sequence, so haven't heard any comment yet on using it for any kind of tracking or. I know there's some possible worry about the rolling shutter on it, making it difficult to track, but I thought it held up beautifully.
Actually,
I'm gonna.
I don't think that the rolling shutter is a big problem. I say that because the rolling shutter issue, for those of you that don't know, is that during the time that the frame is effectively being exposed, it actually does it from the top of the frame to the bottom. So if you think about a camera slowly or quickly panning left to right, the top of the picture is looking straight ahead, and by the time you've got to the bottom of the scan of that single frame, the camera's moved a bit and turned a bit, and so anything that was a vertical is now effectively askew or side on. In other words, the top to the bottom isn't a straight line because the camera is literally turned during the time that the shutter was open, unlike film, which just exposes a whole frame in one whack. That's what we're talking about when we say a rolling shutter, and this was apparent in the short film made I've completely blanked, by Peter Jackson, called Crossing the Line, which was a film shown at NAB last year on a prototype camera of Red. And so this is a problem that exists in digital cameras, and people saw it quite strongly in the Crossing the Line when they were looking for it. But I should point out that that has been dramatically improved in the latest versions of the camera. So I just and I have a Red, so I'm fessing up to that. But I just don't see the rolling shutter as being an issue. And also, you pointed out that it's a problem for tracking. But this is a camera that potentially has more ability to do good tracking than anyone that we've seen before.
Right. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Red. I know you have one. I'm very envious of you, in that aspect. A friend of mine is actually getting five of them in, and I'll be playing with those as soon as those come in. So I'm looking forward to getting my hands both on the camera to shoot as a, as a person interested in film, but also interested in dealing with the data afterwards, as a visual effects artist.
Yeah,
So.
because one of the things that you'll be able to do, and certainly right up your alley, is the fact that the camera is recording simultaneously, or certainly will be, hopefully, by the next release of the software, all of the aspects of the lens while it's filming. So if you think about this for a second, normally we literally have to write down on a piece of paper what lens is on for any given shot, because there's no obvious way that the film camera knows what the lens is doing. It just passes light through the lens to the film. On these new state-of-the-art digital cameras like the RED, actually has a chip in the lens that's feeding information back to the camera. So along with writing down the pictures of Hayden Christensen on a surfboard, it's also writing down that the lens was at this sort of zoom, that the focus was like this, that the f-stop was this. In much the same way that a digital stills camera has that kind of information when you open up in Photoshop that you can see how the shot was done. Only it's doing that up to 100 times a second to make sure that it can record during a zoom. So why is this significant for someone? Someone like David, for example, and I'm sure you'd be one of the first to get your hands on this, is you can actually tell the software, hey, I know that a wide-angle lens is distorting the frame, but now I know exactly what the lens was during this zoom. You can undistort the lens and get my straight line straight again at mathematical accuracy of the lens as it was calibrated at the factory. And so, while some people are claiming that the RED may have this rolling shutter problem, which will make it difficult to tracking, I find it to be the exact opposite. I find it to be probably the most exciting camera for 3D tracking in years.
That's I hadn't heard that yet. About the is that only with the RED lenses, or is that with
No, it was actually something that was developed by Cook. It's called iTech, and iTech allows you on a film camera to do exactly the same thing, except for the fact that the data can't be put on the film, so it has to go on a separate memory chip card in a reader attached to the camera. And as you'd know on set, it's a bit of an ask to say to the camera department, would you mind putting this extra unit on the side of your camera and
yeah, and
making
then
sure
you're
it's
gonna
switched on?
Yeah, you're gonna have to, guarantee that everything is gen locked and time synced, and yeah, I can see definitely how this is a huge advantage, and I'm sure for Cloverfield 2, they'll be very eager to use that feature.
I
Yeah,
mean, I think
I've
the
been
thing that's
tracking it.
really, I think it's really interesting though in Jump. I mean, we've seen the trailers, for example, for Wanted, which, has Morgan Freeman and Angelina Jolie in it. So it's obviously a big film, and that's shot entirely on the RED. But for me, that was just a surprise to come out of a film, looking at it from a visual effects point of view, and suddenly being told, hey, a bunch of those shots in there were actually shot completely digitally on a, on a RED. And I'm a guy who's meant to know RED, right? I mean, I've been filming with it since September. So if I can't pick that intercut, I mean, I can't see how Joe Punter can.
Yeah, I think it all that kind of leads into the argument for people who are so attached to film, to celluloid, that our process these days is everything goes through digital. Even if you shoot on film, chances are you're gonna go through a digital intermediate in order to color time it, or go to a digital negative for digital projection or what have you. So once all your data is coming into the computer, if the data is coming from an analog source like film or a digital source like the RED, it doesn't matter because it's all going to be treated the same and then go out. It's just the quality of the captured image leading into it. So if the RED is everything I've been told it is in terms of color depth and fidelity and everything, it is going to be a game changer.
I think the interesting thing is how digital swept through the stills world, and I mean, somebody actually said to me who was on an R&D team, and he wasn't being arrogant when he said it. He said, "Do you think there's any property of film we can't synthetically replicate with enough compute power?" And at the moment, the big one is dynamic range. In other words, if you shoot the film and don't expose correctly, then you don't have the kind of recovery latitude that you do on a piece of negative. And so we're not saying that it's not a film is dead thing, but it's just a technical equivalence. The digital isn't quite there yet, but every year, every couple of years, it makes such a big advance that when it hits, I mean, the difference between being able to film and post immediately and review stuff immediately and work at 4K resolution over 2K is one thing. But then the other thing we should point out is the reason that you would use a RED on a second unit like this is we're talking about a camera that, is going to be costing around, say, $35,000, including a lens, maybe less. The base part of it only costs $17,500. Now that may seem like an enormous amount of money if you're just about to go out and buy an HDV camera, but it's an absolute fraction of the amount of money that you'd pay even for a high-end HD camera like the F23 or from Sony or the, you know, F900.
Yeah, and that's it's not even the cost of a lens for a Panavision camera. So the cost benefit is immense. I you know, and I've heard many an argument that the Red just produces too much data. But you know, you can right on the camera, you can tell it not to shoot the full res if you don't need it. I know there's arguments to be made to shoot full res, and if you don't need it, throw it away later. But I'll make that decision once I get my hands on a few Red cameras to play with.
Now, getting back to the location stuff they did, one of the things that I thought would have been a set piece but wasn't was actually shooting in the Colosseum. And they actually got unprecedented access to the Colosseum, though with some pretty strict restrictions on how they could film.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that, you know, they weren't allowed to put anything on the ground. They weren't allowed to use any artificial lighting. The thing was, is because of that, it didn't look like the real Colosseum. You know, they were limited to, they didn't have any cranes in there to kind of show off the epicness of the space or that kind of shot. So in a lot of ways, it felt like a soundstage.
You know, you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought of that, but that's absolutely true. When they were down in the middle of the Colosseum, I was thinking set piece because you don't have the big expansive shots, but they couldn't do that because they couldn't, you know, get the gear in there to do it.
Yeah, the last movie I saw that had a similar environment was Ronin with Robert De Niro. Because I just watched that on DVD. It's a brilliant Frankenheimer film, and they have it's not the Colosseum in Rome, but it's a Roman Colosseum in a town in France that they really show off the size and scope of the location. And again, it was shot on location in this Colosseum, but it felt bigger than this huge. I don't know if you've ever been to Rome, but it's an immense structure that you feel really tiny and insignificant inside of. And this didn't. This felt to me like a cover set. And what a cover set is, for people who are listening who don't know, is a set that can be built inside that. If it's raining outside, you go and you shoot your scenes in your cover set. It felt small. It felt confined. It felt like they built a set out of styrofoam that could be destroyed for the fight that they get into. And, I mean, it is a testament to the set builders that when all heck breaks loose during the fight, you can't tell what was the real Colosseum and what was the set, but the... There's no benefit to actually shooting in the Colosseum. They probably would have been better off shooting on a full set so they didn't have to follow these silly restrictions and, you know, not putting anything down on the ground, and then just filming your exteriors at the actual Colosseum.
Yeah, yeah. As shown in contrast to that amazing scene where the Mercedes SL65 jumps through the dealership window in Tokyo, where, of course, they could put down techno cranes and could put down everything else, and then you really got a much sort of almost bigger sense of that play than you did in what should have been the most amazing scene ever.
Yeah, it was a little disappointing. I thought that chase with the Mercedes was pretty darn cool. I thought the way it popped around the screen. I don't know if that was the director's notes or the artist who is doing the shot, but there's a really cool moment where it didn't just jump laterally, it jumped vertically. It was like on top of a street sign for
yeah, I noticed that one. Yeah, it suddenly hit up on the wall and then down again. Yeah, it was very cool.
It was a nice way of using an effect to enhance the character of the person in the film, because it kind of shows off their playfulness that they were and recklessness that they were trying to exhibit in that scene. And that's what a good effect really should do, is it should enhance the character and enhance the story, not just be there to be there. It reminded me a little bit of the sequence in I Am Legend, the opening shot. We're driving through the city. You know, it was a big effects piece to kind of show.
Yeah, the isolation. But see, for me, the thing I liked about that also is that when it popped up high on the street and came back down, if you noticed it, you noticed it and you thought it was really cool, but they didn't overplay it. They didn't do it 8 times. They didn't have three characters kind of look at it and go, whoa. I was just nicely done, I thought.
I think the the thing a lot of directors are going for is they're doing these big effects, but they're not drawing attention to it over and over again in terms of making sure the audience noticed the money they just put on the screen. And it's becoming a nice trend where, you know, in the early days, matte paintings were, they would linger on them for a long, long time, just so you get the idea of, well, we spent all this money on this matte painting, we're going to show it to you. And for a while, it was, we spent all this money on these effects and building this creature, and we're gonna make sure that you appreciate it. And I think we're getting to the point where even these elaborate visual effects are thrown away, for lack of a better word. You know, they're on screen, but if you see them, great. If you don't see them, even better. Because if it draws away from the story, it's failed.
Yeah, I mean, the budget on this film was about 85 million, which is, obviously a good chunk of change, but certainly not into the stratospheric level of some of the big summer blockbusters. And we mentioned already Hydraulics, who I mentioned Jeff works at, but the principal house was Weta. And I have to say, like, when was the last time we saw a Weta film that we thought sucked? I mean, it's just really good, those guys.
Yeah, Weta does incredibly solid work. I'm big fans of them. They're really nice people to work with as well.
And
I guess we should talk about the jump effect itself.
that's what I was heading towards because there's many ways to do that. I've got to say, for me personally, the gotcha moment of, oh my God, that's cool, was actually in X-Men when they was it X-Men 3? They had the teleporting guy. It was two attacking the
It was
president at the
two.
beginning. Yeah,
Yeah, Alan
and I,
Cumming as Nightcrawler.
yeah, and as he jumped, you had an implosion of air from the space he left that caused the kind of particles to sort of zoom into the center. And having seen that effect, I was like, well, it'd be hard to top that. I mean, would you agree? I thought that was like a really definitive, like, when I
Yeah,
first saw that.
well, I think the good thing about the movie is in the past few years we've seen three big teleportation effects that I can remember. The first being Nightcrawler in X-Men 2, which, you know, for to a large part that visually had been designed in the comic books as a way of, you know, there's a puff of black blue smoke, and when they came to doing it on film, they added that implosion effect of sucking the smoke back in, which was a brilliant move, and also the way that they had the smoke kind of linger and fill up that room. And then we had last year we had in Harry Potter 5 or 6, I don't know which one it was, I think 5 last year, the that big fight at the end where you had the wizards kind of teleporting in with their those incredible particles just streaming off of them. Almost like they were had water running off. Do you know the effect I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
That, you know, where they had the evil people in black particles and the good guys in white particles. But it was again the same effect, somebody teleporting in, but they did it in a completely different way. Even though it was smoke coming off of a character, it was a different way. And this was again a very similar effect where there's a displacement of air, and it was, you know, a particle effect, but rather than rendering it as smoke or anything like that, they used it as kind of almost like a heat displacement of light, which I thought was incredibly realistic looking for such a out there effect. I really liked it.
I also liked the fact that it wasn't in your face, that it was sort of happened and you wanted to see a bit more of it, but they didn't do the, I mean, for example, when they kind of went invisible in the room, again, not overused. Maybe they could have set that up slightly more with an earlier allude to it, but I felt like they weren't thumping those things and then sort of lingering on them to get their money's worth out of them. They weren't wringing the effects out.
Yeah, the other part of the effect that happened is because of this implosion of air, they had the things around the room would react to it. You know, you'd have cans and dollar bills swirl around and that sort of thing. And obviously, those were all digital, but they
Yeah, and
blended
that
in.
whole floor treatment of smashing the concrete floor, for example, when he teleports his father to the hospital, and you have that crater effect, which he obviously learned to control, so he didn't destroy his own apartment. But that was a nice feeling of I got a sense of force from doing that.
Yeah, it was a obviously we don't shy away from spoiling the movie on the show, but the girlfriend's apartment when it kind of collapses in, it was very it didn't look like a digital effect. It didn't it came in it, like every board, every bit of debris around the room really looked plausible. It was no there was no thing that's obviously it was digital and my brain, it was going, this is not really happening, but there's nothing about the visuals that screamed, this is digital. It was a really well executed series of in your face invisible effects, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, and I mean, it could have easily been the other way around, right? It could have easily been incredibly overdone.
Right. There was only one shot I did not like in the entire movie, which was during the fight sequence at the end, which I'm not sure, but it looked like it was straight out of Monsters Incorporated. The in terms of if you go, remember the end of that movie where they're going through all the doors,
Yeah.
the big fight at the end where they're
Yeah.
teleporting through all the doors. That's what that sequence reminded me of.
I've got to say, the one that struck out for me was when he was on Big Ben, just because I do a lot of tracking, and I just didn't feel like he was, when it was pulling back and he was leaning out from Big Ben, it just didn't seem locked down as much as I'd expected. It just seemed to have some float in there. Now, that might be me just being a complete bastard, but there you go.
Yeah, the one shot in the end sequence though for me was the fight on top of the pyramid,
Right.
where the camera was kind of doing a full 360 around the top of the pyramid, and it didn't seem like the pyramid and the clouds and the sky and the people on it were completely locked together. It really that's the one shot in the whole movie that felt and looked like it was completely and utterly CG, and didn't feel grounded in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I actually thought that apartment crushing was handled pretty well, actually, because I mean, that didn't look like lots of, composited smoke elements stuck on top of what, I mean, they obviously didn't blow up an apartment block. I mean, they might have put some pyro in there, but they didn't like take out, an entire apartment block during a teleporting phase. But I thought that was pretty well done.
I did too. The interesting thing I gotta wonder is I know early on in the movie, it had the two leads in the movie, Hayden Christensen and Rachel Bilson, were not in the movie. They had other actors who were playing their roles, and I'm wondering if there was any digital paint outs or anything like that that were done on stuff that was already shot to replace the actors. Via blue screen. I didn't see anything in the press about it, but it's
I remember when,
interesting
yeah,
when
I
you
remember when the
replace your
film
two
was being
actors.
made. When the film was being made, it was, from the reports in the press, not the smoothest of. I mean, there's been quite a few, blow-ups of one way or another in the press during the productions. So everything from, as you say, replacing the actors to union things. But it's just so hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, one imagines that. That you'd just have to completely reshoot those scenes, but you're absolutely right. It could have been that they had some actor replacement.
Yeah, because they shot in so many different locations around the world, and getting those permits and the ability to shoot in a location can be difficult. So if they chose to shoot the Tokyo stuff first, for instance, or the London stuff first, if you replace your actors and then you have to come back and reshoot those scenes, you might not be able to shut down traffic again or have access to the same locations or what have you in that time frame when you replace your actors. I know a lot of times, for after an edit is done of a movie, they'll need a shot or two. They'll bring the actors in, and they'll build a tiny little piece of the location in order to ground your actors in that location, you know, for an insert of a close up or whatever, in order to get the story point across that the editor needs. So I don't know if they might have done that at all. You know, like I said, it's not in the press, but it's an interesting thing when you have to make a drastic change to your movie for whatever reason, whether it's the death of an actor or the recasting for marketing reasons or what have you.
Yeah. I've got to say the worst decision for me was that blonde haircut thing. What the heck was that about? You know, if you're going to be a secret agent, or if you're going to be like somebody running a secret organization, don't, you know, have the most obvious identifiable haircut in history and drive the most loudest souped up car in history. You know what I mean? I know it's not very sexy to be, but you know, whereas the Bourne Identity, you've always kind of felt was, but this was, you know, pushing some of my buttons for just, you know, come on, like, I don't know, there's like, if you're going to do The Matrix, go the whole way. And if you're not going to do The Matrix, then, you know, try and kind of be in character.
Yeah, it was, you know, the movie is adapted from a book. And I was reading about some of the differences between the book and the movie. And they're pretty drastic. It actually sounds like the book is pretty darn interesting. I'm going to grab it from Audible if it's there and give it a listen, because it is very different. But one of the things I think our audience might be interested in is, in the book, the with something like teleportation, you can teleport as much as you want in a book because it costs you nothing. But in a film, you have to, you know, if the character's teleporting, you have to put it on screen, or at least let the audience know that they're teleporting. So one of the things they did in the film has absolutely nothing to do with visual effect. Is they added a sound effect to the teleportation. You know, they had that kind of sound of the vacuum of air and all that kind of stuff going on. In the book, it's completely silent. But in the film, they added a sound effect. And if you notice, more than a few times, they would have, you know, a shot of a character reacting to somebody teleporting and just play the sound effect. And that's like one of those nice ways, by deviating from your source material or your source idea, that you can, you know, drive the story along and say, okay, well, it's much easier to play a sound effect than it is to put in a, you know, $800,000 visual effect shot. So,
I'm sure that Weta and the other VFX houses involved would have loved to have got $800,000 for each one of those teleporting effects. I think that it was, but yeah, I get your point. And I think the thing is that once again, as we've said many times in the past, sound plays such a great role, and it can actually play very strongly just having the teleporting happening off screen.
Right. You know, overall, like I said, it was a decent movie. Not great, but not bad. So if you like Doug Liman's visual style, you know, that he used in Go or Swingers or Bourne Identity, this very much follows into that same directing style. Very realistic, a lot of handheld, but not to the extent of a Cloverfield or United 93 film. So it's a decent film with some good effects that are in your face but not overpowering and don't take over the frame, which I appreciated.
The only thing I'd say is that there was a section at the end there that was jumping around so much in close-ups and handhelds that I really figured, I have no idea what's going on here. At some point, this montage of flashy bits of water and other stuff are going to subside, and then I'll get an idea of who's left standing. I mean, it really got to a point I had no idea where people were and the spatial relationships of each other. And when
one of the big jobs of an editor is to provide the audience with exactly that. What's the cartography of the scene? You know, what's the spatial relationships of this character to that character to the environment? But how do you handle that when the character can be in multiple locations within the flash of an eye?
I disagree with you there. The sequence I'm talking about, when the house section goes underwater, it wasn't a teleportation problem. It was
just
a rapid editing problem. And
you're right.
I just think I kind of lost it at that point. I don't understand why, and maybe it didn't matter that I didn't know, because maybe the disorientation is what the audience was, except for the fact that it took me... Sorry, the characters were experiencing is the same disorientation I had. But the problem was, it took me out of the film. you mean? For that instant, I was like, okay, I don't know what's going on now. I guess I'll get it again in a second, versus, rooting for the guy to win or watching out because he's, around the corner with the knife kind of thing.
I know exact. I had the identical experience, which was, I was didn't know. I was like, who's underneath what? And wait, is he free or is he not free? Or, I couldn't. I agree. I could not tell what was going on in that scene. All I knew is they were in the water.
Yeah, and I couldn't even tell whether he was falling away from her, she was swimming up to him. I mean, I got that they were swimming together. Was she gonna, was he dead? It was just a shame to be that chaotic. Because you know what? I didn't get that in like a Bourne Identity. No matter how much it was prone to causing seasickness, I still knew, which way was up. And I
Right.
literally got to a point with this film where I did not know which way was up.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was the filmmaker's intention or not. But in my not so humble opinion, I agree. It was not at all. It was not Cinema 101.
Yeah, now I guess that just leaves the I mean, there were obviously a bunch of effects houses that worked on this. We've mentioned only but two. Do you want to just give a shout out to some of the other effects houses that that worked on it?
Well, we had a, we had a
Because we
Lola
discussed,
FX,
yeah, well,
which
Lola
they're
is effectively a division of Hydraulics, well, sister
exactly.
company.
They're one of those companies that no one's supposed to know exists. We got Riot here in LA, Gentle Giant, who does amazing scanning and model building and that sort of kind of middleware of the VFX industry.
Actually, Riot's been doing good work as well. Riot had, I'm pretty sure, I don't know what they did, but I'm pretty sure they got a pretty strong matte painting department over at Riot.
Yeah, they do. Mainly they have a, they're one of those houses that really do a lot of work in commercials and music videos and you don't often see them credited on visual effects films, but I thought they did a good job. This is one of those films that you had a lot of shops doing a few shots rather than one shot doing everything, which you'll see more and more going into the future. Soho did some stuff on this. I don't know if I'm missing anybody.
And as we said, the principal of visual effects were led by Weta, and on a film that was obviously not the biggest blockbuster budget, but was pretty heavily promoted in the U.S. as I understand it. Certainly here, I think it was promoted a lot less, partly because of the bad reviews it was getting, and yet it had a pretty good opening weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it was like $30 million or $32 million. They're trying to turn that whole Valentine's Day, President's Day thing into a big holiday movie-going event weekend, which kind of seems they're forcing that on us. But I don't know if Valentine's Day was really the right holiday to release this film. It doesn't really seem like a romantic movie to me, but and
Well,
after.
the theory is nowadays that you do something that seems completely odd and you just call it counter-programming. I mean, enter Alien versus Predator 7 or what it was released on
Christmas.
it was like, what the? And well, it's counter-programming. It's insanely clever. And you go, well, it's in clever if it works, and if it doesn't, it was just dumb.
Yeah.
No, I think it was pretty interesting film, and I enjoyed it. I think you'd probably be wasted if you were trying to watch it on the back of an airline seat. But you're right, you could watch it easily on DVD and on Blu-ray and have a good time, or on a download and have a good time. But it was also good in the cinema.
Yeah, I think it's because of the inherently frantic nature of the effect. You're here, you're there. I think there's probably a lot more detail in the teleportation effect than you were able to appreciate in the film itself as it goes by. This will definitely be for me a Blu-ray purchase because I'm definitely going to want to, frame by frame that effect and just see exactly what kind of 2D warping they were doing and what
It's
kind of.
so funny you say that, because I was about to say exactly the same thing. Must have Blu-ray for me, but mainly for me because I want to side by side those red frames with those non-red frames.
Yeah, it's I really enjoy going in there and analyzing invisible effects frame by frame just to see exact like in Final Destination when that girl gets hit by the bus. I went through frame by frame just to see exactly how they did that.
But you know, David, you and I, the reason that the visual effects industry is suffering because they have to make things, perfect in every frame, because jerks like us are going to sit there with the step one frame button on our Blu-ray players, go, ooh, ooh,
Yeah, it'll be scarier when we're critiquing. Well, the first 45 frames of that shot were excellent, but 46 through 48 were garbage.
Oh, and
And
58. Oh my God, how did 58 get through?
exactly, some visual effect. Someone had a day off.
Yeah, but having said that, like if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably in exactly the same boat that we are. So
Yes.
you're amongst friends.
Speaking of which, actually, I know we don't really do recommendations and such on the show, but since the whole Blu-ray HD DVD battle has now been won by Blu-ray, if people have an HD DVD player and have not yet purchased the Frighteners Director's Cut on HD DVD, I don't know if it will ever be released on Blu-ray, but it is available on HD DVD, and it is an amazing, amazing addition to any collection. There's a 4-hour making of documentary on the disc that was actually shot by Peter Jackson himself during the making of the film because it was targeted. They keep on referring to it as a laser disc. But there's multiple things that are interesting about it. It's they do a lot of fly on the wall where they just kind of have the camera sit there and run. And you watch as the action unfolds on the set. So it's very much like being on a set. So if you've never been on a movie set, it's very interesting. But they also are talking about Weta, who did the effects in this film, back at the formation of Weta and Weta Digital, where they talk about their whopping 1.6 terabytes of storage space for the entire facility, their how some composites could have as many as three or sometimes four layers. It's a very interesting look into what the state of digital effects were like in 95, 96 when that film was done. And how far we've come in 10 very, very short years. So if you have an HD DVD player, I highly recommend picking up the disc. It's a fantastic film, but two, it's a cut of the film that's never been seen before, but it's a for behind the scenes look at how digital effects films are made and were made 10 years ago and really haven't changed all that much. It's a really amazing disc, so I just like to highly recommend that to everybody.
Sounds
Get it while you
good.
can.
And I'll put a plug in for the fact that we have a new writer over on FX Guide. And so by the time this podcast goes up, there should be a story on the jumper written not by me, but by Bill. So hopefully that's good. I haven't even read it myself yet, but he's been talking to the guys at Weta, and that'll be on fxguide.com. I'm sure Alex will be back with us next week, and hopefully Mark and some of the other regular gang will be returning. But I want to say thanks for taking time out, David, for joining us.
No problem. Fun as always.
How did the stand-up gig go, by the way? You alluded to that on an earlier
Yeah,
podcast.
it went really well. For those who don't know, I'm a stand-up comic and writer as well as a visual effects artist, and I perform regularly all around LA. Went really well. I'm actually nominated for a couple of awards for comedy in LA and for 2007, so I'll find out on March 6 whether I won anything, and I'll let you guys know.
And hopefully soon after they'll give you your own HBO special.
Yeah, that would be fun, but I wouldn't look for it anytime soon. Comedy is more of an outlet for me to write than anything else. I'm a little bit too old to pursue a career in comedy. Although, you know what? Today is actually Robert Altman's birthday, and Robert Altman didn't have his big break until he was 45. So you're never too old, I suppose.
Well, speaking of someone that hasn't hit 45, I'll take that as good advice. Hey, thanks so much, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back next week. I think. Well, actually, I'm not quite sure what film we're doing next week. Do you know what it is?
I think we're doing Spiderwick Chronicles.
Ah, okay. Sounds cool. Lots of little creatures running around. Until then, you've been listening to the VFX show. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, see you later. Goodbye.